Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Dear Evan Hansen opened on Broadway in 2016 and reached a level of virality that few musicals achieve. The original cast album debuted in 2017 at number 8 on the Billboard 200, the highest of any cast recording since Camelot in 1961, higher even than Hamilton. The Broadway production was nominated for 9 Tony Awards and won Best Musical, Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, and Best Lead Actor for Ben Platt. And now it's making the transition to film, with Platt reprising the lead role of the anxious social outcast who finds himself caught in an increasingly grave lie. Here's a clip of Platt from the film singing one of the show's biggest hits, You Will Be Found.
Let that lonely feeling wash away. Maybe there's a reason to believe you'll be okay. 'Cause when you don't feel strong enough to stand, you can reach out your hand. And oh, someone will come running, and I know they'll take you home. Even when the dark comes crashing through, when you need a friend to carry you, and when you're broken on the ground, you will be found.
In addition to Platt, its cast includes some of film's biggest names like Julianne Moore and Amy Adams, and yes, they sing too. It was directed by Stephen Chbosky, who is also known for another hit high school story, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Chbosky wrote the original novel and directed its film adaptation. He's adapted screenplays for the film versions of Rent and Beauty and the Beast, but this is his first time in the director's chair for a musical. Stephen, welcome to All of It.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And before we continue, listeners, we just want to let you know that this conversation will touch on topics of mental illness and suicide. If you or anyone you know is experiencing suicidal thoughts, please know you're not alone. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 1-800-273-8255 to speak with someone 24 hours a day. Stephen, so you saw the stage show about 3 years ago. What convinced you there was a movie in this and that you really wanted to be involved?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. You know, when I went in blind. I didn't know anything about the story. I'd heard maybe Waving Through a Window a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of people, I was just blown away by it. The power of it, the characters, the writing was phenomenal. The songs were great. And what convinced me it could be a movie was, you know, when I did my film, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, that you mentioned, you know, I saw the effect that it had for young people. Mm-hmm. And so here I saw this beautiful show on Broadway, and I thought about the millions upon millions of people that are never going to be able to afford a Broadway ticket, kids, you know, that don't have that kind of money, or even if they did, that may live in a place where they can't make it to, like, even a traveling company. So I thought a movie theater, you know, everybody can find their way to a movie theater, and most people can afford at least that ticket, and I just thought it would be great for millions and millions of kids and their families who love them and want to understand these things a little bit better.
You said in interviews that you really chased this movie, but that you also wanted to meet with the show's writers to share your thoughts to make sure that you all vibed together and you were okay with each other's thoughts. Was that the writer in you that led to that decision?
Oh, for sure. You know, when I did even my last movie, Wonder, before this one, you know, I met with R.J. Palacio for Wonder, and here I met with the three guys. Just because I revere authors, I think they created the show. It's my job to help translate or adapt it for the screen, but ultimately it's theirs, and it's their baby. And I've never understood, maybe it's just the way I was raised, I never understood artists that come in and are wrecking balls and say, no, it's my vision, and no, you can all go away. I was like, no. To me, Stephen Levinson, you know, Pasek and Paul, they're the three who wrote this. It's their call, and luckily they agreed and they picked me.
The movie does make some changes to the stage show, including a couple of songs, you had to get rid of a couple of songs, and then you added a couple of new ones. What led to the decision to make those changes?
Well, you know, not to get too granular with it, but
oh, go for it. We love granular.
Oh, you love granular? Okay, I'll go granular. Those of you, you know, in your audience and people like us who love musicals, we know sometimes songs are simply performative, meaning great song in the show. Does anybody have a map? I love the song in the show. It's very performative, where it's like you're meeting all the people and you're meeting all the characters. And then when we started looking at it, it was me and the whole team, the producers, we all sat down and we looked at each song and said, what would happen if this went away? And then suddenly when you took away Anybody Have a Map and you started with Waving Through a Window, you realized, oh, we're going to meet all these characters anyway through Evan. It made the experience more subjective for Evan. So that's one example. Another example is those of you who know the show. There's this wonderful convention that they have on stage that Michael Greif brilliantly directed, where Evan is talking to Connor, kind of the alter ego Connor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely convention, but in film, in real locations, it would almost feel like, oh, is he a ghost? What is it? It didn't quite translate because it felt more theatrical. So once we took out that, that led to the need to replace the song Disappear, and that led to kind of a win-win situation where we had this opportunity to create this new song, The Anonymous Ones, and have more time spent with the character of Alana, who we were able to deepen her character. So there was a lot of win-wins about these decisions. And I could go song by song if you want, but just overall, we just felt like, you know, getting rid of the performative songs and then ultimately turning a two-act musical into a three-act movie necessitated some of these changes. But for me, since I was a huge fan of the show from the very first time I saw it, I made the film as a fan. And so none of these changes were taken lightly. They were all done for, we all felt, very good reasons, and I hope people agree.
Let's actually take a listen to one of those new tracks, the one you just mentioned, The Anonymous Ones, which is sung by Alana, who befriends Evan and then starts a charity with him in Connor's name. And she's played by Amandla Sternberg. Let's listen to The Anonymous Ones.
You know, you don't really act like a depressed sort of person.
There are a lot of people who feel like us. People that you wouldn't think. You ever look at all the people who seem to know exactly how to be? You think they don't need piles of prescriptions to function naturally? Well, look again and you might catch it. Just stay a minute more. There's this little moment after the sunny smile as their eyes fall to the floor. The anonymous ones never let you see the ache they carry. All of those anonymous ones who never name that quiet pain they bury.
That was from the film version of Dear Evan Hansen. I'm speaking with its director, Stephen Chbosky. So those characters of Alana and Connor get a bit more fleshed out in the film than they are in the show. Why was that important?
Well, it's important because, you know, when you do a movie, and I think also Cynthia and Larry also got a little bit more time because, you know, the close-up does a lot. You know, as brilliantly as the show is staged, and it really is by Michael Greif, it's, you know, even if you have the best ticket in the house, you're still 25 feet away from everybody. And so what movies allow you to do is be very economical with how you introduce characters and how you flesh them out. And so we just felt like once you put all of this in the real world and once you put this family's grief in close up,
mm-hmm.
everything had to get a little bit more, everything had to deepen. And everything had to match tonally to justify that and to reinforce that sense of reality. It was very very important for all of us. Plus, I think on some level, not that I would ever speak for them, I wouldn't, but, you know, the author's been watching the show for years and years and years and years, and I think they probably, you know, every artist I know has said, oh, maybe I could do that differently. They have those things that nag them. I have things in the Person Being a Wallflower book that I would change if I had a time machine, a couple little things. And, you know, they were able to kind of correct some of those things that bothered them. So that was great to see.
Evan as a character is so complex, and people have really strong reactions to him because he makes some pretty bad decisions, even if it's not with the worst intentions. But he ends up engaging this horrible deception, something that a lot of people would consider unforgivable. How did you think about that line, that idea that you want us to go on this journey with Evan, but also that Evan has done something really terrible?
Well, to me, you know, what it's, I found the passion has been actually very exciting to witness, you know, from my vantage point. Because, look, I'm one of the people that I have great sympathy for the character. I did from day one when I saw it on stage. And on stage, the lie is actually much darker and much, you know, it takes a lot of different turns that we don't do in the movie. But even so, this is how I feel about it. That ultimately, I really didn't make a movie about a kid who lies or a liar. I felt like I made a movie about a kid who had to learn how to tell the truth. Not only about, obviously, his relationship with Connor, but about himself and how troubled he really is. This kid needs help. He's a troubled soul, and considering especially over the last year and a half what the pandemic has done to the mental well-being of our young people as a society, I just thought that to lean into the mental health aspects of it, to talk about you know, his depression, his anxiety, and all the reasons why he tells the lie in the first place, not only for his own benefit, or the things that he's working through, but also the family's grief. You know, when he's first confronted with the letter, the first thing he says is, oh, Connor didn't write this. He didn't write this. And the family will not listen. You know, he tries to tell the truth several times, and they won't have it. And then eventually, I think with no malice in his heart whatsoever, he goes along with the story that he thinks that they need to hear, you know? And so it's a very complicated situation. And, you know, I think it's beyond just a simple, you know, moral dismissal of like, oh, he's a liar and he's irredeemable personally. But, you know, look, we're all entitled to our opinions. So let the debate begin.
And I think there will be a debate, because one of the things that's really interesting and I think really effective is we really do get the sense, the pain of Connor's family. And that's also something I think the film really achieves, which does make it, which makes you have to question back and forth about what Evan's done and the way the family has reacted. That's something that the film is, I really enjoyed about the film, because a lot of musicals we've seen, and it's really fun, and there's spectacles, and it's jazz hands, and it's bright colors.
Oh, yeah.
But this film is really... the songs come in organically, and it's really intimate in a way that you don't sometimes get with musicals. I'm curious how you achieved that. Did you think about that, considering the storyline?
Completely. And it means a lot to me that you said what you said. One of the nicest compliments I received was actually from our star, Ben Platt, who wrote me this text that basically said that the movie was quietly revolutionary. In the sense, like you said, usually, and I love movie musicals, I
me
love them
too.
All, you know, the flashier the better. But this one, because it takes place in dining rooms and bedrooms, and it's about real people. What we did as a team is we decided like that live singing, that would be our cornerstone. That when you see them on camera, that is them singing. Unless, you know, the high school, there's, you know, extras tromping through or kids like that ruin the take or whatever. But even then, we did wild track singing in the school. So when you see it, you're really watching them sing. So that was really important to us. But also, the approach to say, that the dialogue is no different than the lyrics, that it's the same. We recorded it the same. We use the same microphones. And the songs sneak up on you. And they're not trying to be flashy. It's not like there's a bunch of talking and then you stop and then the color changes and here we go. It's more of like, no, it's a drama with songs. It's just an extension of the story itself. And that was really wonderful to do. It was a real leap of faith that we all took together, because we couldn't really think of an example of a movie musical that tried to do it this way. But you know, when you have like Ben Platt and Amy Adams and Julianne Moore and all these amazing performers, I don't know, it just somehow it really worked. There was a real alchemy and magic that happened with simply by being matter of fact about it.
My guest is Stephen Chbosky. We're talking about the film version of Dear Evan Hansen. It'll be out in theaters on September 24th. Let's talk about the Ben Platt of it all. There are people who say, this is Ben Platt's role. It could only ever be Ben Platt. It has to be Ben Platt, that voice, the charisma. And then there's the idea, oh gosh, Ben Platt's now 27 years old. Can he play someone who's a high schooler? And there's been a lot of jabs and piling on about that. But I'm curious, when you were doing the casting, how much conversation, if there was conversation, was there about Ben being in this role, about the idea of can we do this mix of ages?
Well, I mean, there was some discussion, but for me, it was a no-brainer. You know, I actually never saw him perform it on stage myself. I just heard it on the soundtrack. But just hearing it on the soundtrack and just meeting him and knowing that he had done, he helped create the role from the very first workshop. To me, it was his role. And to preserve what he can do, because anybody that's seen the movie or has seen him live on stage, you know, this kid is almost a physiological impossibility. To be able to have a nervous breakdown, sing with an open throat, then cry, and then sing with a delicate vibrato, and then emote, he does something that I have personally never seen anyone else do. I've heard there are a couple other Broadway people that have this in their canon as well. But it is remarkable. Plus, he's funny. Plus, he can dance. Plus, he is winning. And he is genuinely an authentic person. And he's a kind person. So, to me, there was no other Evan. You know, it was. I wanted to build it around him. That was it. And in terms of, it's very funny. I've been very taken by, or surprised by, some of the depth of talking about his age or whatever it is people are talking about, because some of my favorite movie, like I've made movies about teenagers in high school before. I have cast people who were older than Ben in those roles. I've never heard anybody say there are other members of the cast who are as old as Ben, and no one says boo about them. I think maybe at the end of the day, because he performed it years ago when he was younger, and we have pictures and we know and we can compare, that he just feels a little bit older. But to me, usually people say what they say until they see the movie, and then they see the movie, and the vast, vast majority of the people who see it are just blown away by what he can do and get lost in the performance the way that I did as the director.
I want to play another clip, one that doesn't have singing in it. It does have Julianne Moore playing Evan's mother, Heidi, and she has just met Connor's parents. Evan has grown close to them. They still believe that Evan and Connor were very good friends. And Evan is given the impression that he and his mother aren't able to pay for his college, and they need financial assistance. She works in a hospital. Let's take a listen to this clip from Dear Evan Hansen.
Mom, just hold on.
No, I think I better get to work, see if I can grab a shift now that I know how concerned you are about our finances.
Mom, will you please come back inside?
Oh, my God. Are you kidding me?
Will you just come back inside, please?
They think you're their son, these people.
They're not these people.
They don't really know you.
Well, they like me. They like me. I know that that's very hard for you to believe, that they don't think I'm, you know, that there's something wrong with me, that I need to be, like, fixed like you do.
When have I ever said that?
Oh, my God. Wow, I have to go to therapy, right? I have to take drugs.
There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with needing help, honey.
I know that there is, and I know that I'm a burden. I'm the worst thing that ever happened to you, and I just ruined your life, okay?
No, you are the best thing. You're the best thing that's ever happened to me.
That's Julianne Moore and Evan. Excuse me, Ben Platt from Dear Evan Hansen, the film. I'm speaking with the film's director, Stephen Chbosky. And let me ask you about that director's chair, because you've adapted screenplays for Rent and Beauty and the Beast, but this is your first time in the director's chair. What was exciting about it, and what was surprising about it?
That's a great question. I've grown up loving musicals. I've loved them from the time that I could admit that I loved them. You know, I did grow up in Pittsburgh. I was supposed to be a jock. I was supposed to be a lot of things, but I love them. And you know, working on the screenplay for Rent and Beauty and the Beast, I was able to work with some remarkable directors. The first director involved with Rent was Spike Lee. This was 2001. That version ultimately didn't happen, but I learned a lot from him. Chris Columbus, who did the the version of Rent that finally made it to the theaters. You know, he invited me to set. He was incredibly gracious and open, and then I worked for Bill Condon on Beauty and the Beast, who's another terrific director. And what I found, you know, but I just couldn't wait to get into the chair myself. And I learned from these three guys, and I think what was most surprising about it was just how fun it could be, those moments like in Sincerely Me, when the whole point is just to have a great time, you know, and you're constructing the number as a traditional musical number that's supposed to get laughs and have dancing and a lot of fun. That was my one true number in the movie. And I cannot wait to make more of them, more musicals, because there's something genuinely joyful about doing it. And I think, especially considering what we've all been through, finding an excuse to sing is a great idea. So I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
My guest has been Stephen Chbosky. He is the director of the film version of Dear Evan Hansen. It will be out in theaters on September 24th. Stephen, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
The former Silicon Valley superstar Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of the blood testing startup Theranos, is now on trial for wire fraud. So far, there's been a whistleblower, a person pretending to be someone else, and a juror excused for financial hardship. We'll get the details from NPR's Bobby Allen next.